Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Big thanks this week to Audible.com for supporting the podcast. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kara. That's audiblepodcast.com/Kara. And I want to thank everybody who supports the podcast in the many ways that you do by going to KaraSantaMaria.com, by shopping in the Talk Nerdy store, by looking through my reading list online. What else is there? By rating and reviewing via iTunes and Stitcher, and of course, by supporting the show financially, those of you who are able to do so. So I want to give a shout out this week to Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, Chuck Pell, and Warren Rogers. The four of you, plus countless others, have made this episode of Talk Nerdy possible by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging to be a patron. Thank you guys all so much. Now, I'm really excited about this week's episode. You know how much I love it when I get to have a When I get to have a physicist on the podcast, especially an astrophysicist. And this week was just such a pleasure to have Dr. Chiara Mingarelli to teach me everything. Well, actually, probably honestly just scratch the surface of gravitational waves. It's a real treat. In a couple places, I got a little lost. I tried to stay on track, and hopefully it all makes sense to you guys. And it helps you delve a little bit into a topic that, I don't know, we just don't often get to talk about. So without further ado, here she is, Dr. Chiara Mingarelli. Chiara, thank you so much for making the trek all the way from Pasadena, land of the Big Bang Theory.
My pleasure.
I'm looking forward to our chat. We met very, very recently at our friend Dave, our mutual friend David, Jason Goldman's birthday party.
Yeah.
And you were there with Katie Mack. So funny because Jason and Katie have both been on the podcast.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were actually early on the podcast because we used to have these fun Cosmos viewing parties. And Katie was in town for one of them. So I stole her while she was in town.
Wonderful. Good for you.
And so it was cool because when we were chatting, we realized that we both recently recorded a segment with Megan Amram.
That's right, for Smart Girls. For Smart Girls. Experimenting with Megan Amram.
Should be so much fun. I actually was tweeting back and forth with her the other day, so I think we're going to get her on the podcast too, which will
wonderful.
Be really fun.
Yeah. Awesome.
So that's cool. That's like a weird connection that we didn't know about. But then when you told me that you are a physicist, that you're over at Caltech, that you work on gravitational waves, but you said you're not a cosmologist. So no. I'm like really confused about this now, and I'm really excited to dig into what are gravitational waves. Do we know for a fact that they exist? What is the evidence that supports them? All that good stuff. We did talk about gravitational waves really briefly when Lawrence Krauss was on the podcast, and we talked about BICEP 2, but that was when the finding was first announced, and everybody's really, really excited about it.
Okay.
And so we can get into that, but we don't have to. But the first thing I want to ask you is, and this is probably the question that'll carry us through the whole thing, what the hell is a gravitational wave?
Okay, well, that's a great question and a good place to start. So let me start by trying to paint a picture for you. Mm-hmm. So we see the universe these days through this Einsteinian framework where space-time itself is like a big sheet of lycra or spandex. It's this pliable kind of material that you can stretch and squash.
Okay. And so that's like when you see the pictures of a black hole or something. It's the 2D being stretched into the 3D space and the little cone kind of going
down. That's right.
That's
right. So that's like a gravity well.
Gotcha.
So this is the new way of thinking about gravity. Back in the day when Newton came up with these Newtonian laws, we thought that gravity was this magical force between two things that have mass and they make them come together.
Yeah, see, that's kind of what I thought it was. I think that's what most people still think it is. Most people in the general population.
And that's, you know, that's partly our fault for not communicating these, you know, new paradigms properly. But it's really not that difficult to think about gravity the way that Einstein did. And that's the picture that you just referred to, this well. So gravity is the curvature of this space-time. So things that have mass make these little wells in the fabric of space-time, and things fall into the wells, and that's gravity.
And so it's almost like a mathematical or kind of a geometric explanation for what Newton was saying, right? That this big heavy thing and this big heavy thing, when they're near to each other, there's an attractive force. But really it's that when there's a big heavy thing out there in space, it bends space-time.
Absolutely. That is exactly right. It makes gravity just it's a geometric feature of the universe.
So that's gravity, but what's a gravitational wave?
That's right. So it was important to try to understand thinking about gravity in that way. So now that we can accept that gravity is the bending of this fabric of space-time, now you can imagine shaking that fabric of space-time and little waves come out, like little waves traveling on the surface of the ocean.
That's why you said it was like Lycra.
Exactly. And so gravitational waves are ripples in the fabric of space-time, and they travel at the speed of light.
And so kind of very naive question. Does space-time constantly ripple because it's always in flux? Or is it something where, you know, a massive body like a planet or a star has to physically move in order to create a ripple? Like, why does something wave?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the gravitational waves that I look for come from massive bodies like supermassive black holes that are starting to orbit each other. So galaxies have supermassive black holes at their center. Our very own Milky Way hosts a supermassive black hole, which is about 4.6 million times the mass of the sun.
That's big.
It's pretty big. It's pretty big.
Pretty hard for me to envision what that even means. But yeah, that's really big.
It's huge. And so when the Milky Way collides with another galaxy, say Andromeda, the supermassive black hole at the center of Andromeda and the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way will start to orbit each other, and they'll start to merge.
Gotcha.
And that merging of black holes causes these ripples of space-time, these gravitational waves. But the ones that I study come from very far away. So by the time those ripples get here, they're kind of like just little tiny waves lapping at the side of a lake and not, you know, a massive tsunami that they might have been when they started out.
So they really do decay across distance.
Absolutely.
And so
one over the distance.
Is it little math there. I love it. Just a little math. Just air math. You couldn't see that.
For the interested listener.
And so is it just things like supermassive black holes that cause gravitational waves? Or does the Earth orbiting the sun, does the moon orbiting the Earth? I mean,
all of these things produce gravitational waves.
They
absolutely
do. So anything that has gravity.
Yeah, any accelerating masses produce gravitational waves. So you and I, if we were to start spinning around like at the end of some sort of Scottish dance, right, we would make little tiny gravitational waves.
Really? Even something as small as us?
That's right. It just makes really, really small gravitational waves that don't really affect anything.
So then does that become a problem if you're trying to look at, for example, supermassive black holes from, you know, like just tons of light years away, but then you have signals coming from our own solar system that are bombarding you too? How do you sort out what comes from where?
Oh, that's a great question. So gravitational waves all have different wavelengths, just like how light or electromagnetic radiation, for people who know a little bit more about that, there's, there's visible light and there's very low frequency light and there's very high frequency light. We've got this whole spectrum that you can think about that people are used to thinking about. With gravitational waves, it's the same thing. You have very high frequency gravitational waves, which come from, for example, two solar mass black holes spiraling each other. So while I personally am interested in supermassive black holes, there's black holes pretty much with any mass that you can think of. So from one solar mass to a million, some of them are a billion solar masses.
So like when I know it's a totally different question, but when our sun dies, will it cause a black hole?
It won't, because it's not heavy enough.
Lame.
So yeah, it's not, our sun isn't massive enough to make a black hole. So it will eventually puff up to become a red giant. And then all of that gas will get blown away. And what will be left is its core, which by then will be this kind of carbon oxygen ball called a white dwarf.
Okay.
But those can also be really beautiful because you can think of it almost like a giant diamond, right? You've got this kind of crystalline structure of really, really compressed carbon. And so even though our sun's not going to turn into a black hole, you think, well, it might turn into a beautiful diamond, and that's probably just as good.
That's more lovely, I would say. It's yeah. It's a beautiful diamond that stays there for you know.
It's all understated, of the, you know.
For all of the dead animals and plants and people on Earth to enjoy. No, that's great because it's not. It doesn't become like a. I don't even know what a black hole is. It's just a nothing. It's like a. It's an inversion of.
Yeah.
Like,
so
what is
so,
it really?
Yeah. So black holes are just what happens at the end of a life of something like a star. That's maybe 20 to 25 times the mass of the sun or more
so
when it starts out life.
So it's not about how big it is. It's about how like dense it is.
It's about its mass.
Yeah, okay.
It's about its mass. The mass is the most important thing. And what's interesting, what makes black holes black is the fact that light can't escape from them. So there's this concept called escape velocity. So how hard do you have to throw something so that what comes up doesn't come down again? Right. So for the Earth, for example, the escape velocity is about 11 kilometers per second.
And so that's like how fast a spaceship has to go in order to not be stuck in orbit or to fall right back down.
Well, there's a few levels of complexity, but essentially, yes,
okay.
That's the right way of thinking yeah. about it. And the escape velocity of the sun, for example, is 611 kilometers per second. So you have to go really fast to get outside the well that we're all in, mm-hmm. right, around the sun. So you can think of our all the planets around the sun just being in these stable orbits and those penny machines that sometimes you have at the airport, right, where you make donations and they spiral and spiral really, really fast.
Yeah.
So we're just in a really stable part of that. We're not actually going to fall in. To the sun. We're in a stable orbit.
And that's the thing that's always been kind of confusing to me that actually Jen Ouellette, who has also been on the podcast, made a statement one time when we were at this science event. And I think that we're so used to this concept of like black holes suck things in. They're like giant vacuums. And she's like, yeah, they don't do that.
No.
And I was like, oh, okay.
No. In a sense, well, they're definitely not holes. And they're only black because the light coming out of them is like water coming out of a fountain. It kind of goes up, but it doesn't have enough energy. It can't go fast enough to escape the gravity, to escape that well. So it falls back in on itself.
So it's a real thing. Like it's a real tangible thing in space-time.
Absolutely.
And there's stuff going on in there that yep. that's hard for us to observe because there's no light and there's no signal to tell us.
That's right.
But we can say because of the way that everything around it acts.
Yeah.
As probably a black hole right there.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes when things get close to a black hole, they get torn apart into these, you know, into their component particles. And those things can get heated up and emit light. And so we can see these disks around black holes, like maybe if people saw Interstellar, there was an accretion disk, is what it's called, around Gargantua, this black hole. And so the light can escape from those because it's on the right side of the black hole's event horizon, which is the point of no return.
And that's really kind of that edge. And we think of it as being some sort of a vacuum, but that's not a vacuum like a vacuum, but like a vacuum cleaner, like something that sucks things out from around it. But that's not an appropriate way to think of it because if you're outside of the event horizon, you're cool.
Exactly. Most of the time. Most yeah. of the time. Exactly. So you have these stable circular orbits that you can have around black holes, and that changes if the black hole is spinning or not, for example. So those are really interesting things. But one thing to remind you that black holes don't suck is that, is that if you were to replace the sun with a black hole of the same mass, we wouldn't really notice any difference.
Except that we couldn't have life because we wouldn't have photosynthesis. But other than that.
Well, I think that... I think that that's arguable. I think really? That there may be, yeah, life without photosynthesis.
Yeah, that's true. We'd probably have to reorganize. We could have like a, I recently had an astrobiologist on and we were talking about Europa. Like we could have a whole new system.
Exactly.
With tidal energy and all that. We'd probably die. You know, if it happened pretty suddenly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we would be screwed. Yeah. But what about things like the extremophiles that live in the vents at the bottom of the ocean? They don't care if there's a sun or not.
Totally. And then there would be just whole new life forms that evolve out of that. So you're right. We'd be cool. But I might notice, right? But the...
Yeah, living in California, I think we would miss it the most.
We'd probably, we'd notice. But you're right. There'd be organisms that didn't notice at all. That's really cool. So we wouldn't get any... What about like Mercury? Would Mercury notice? Would Mercury be like in the black hole?
No, I mean, so Mercury would be the event horizon of the black hole that would be made by the sun would be, it's fairly small. So the light crossing time for that is about 5 microseconds. So it would be a very small black hole.
It'd be kind of just where the sun is now.
Yeah. And so the only thing that you need to think about really when it comes to gravity and the mass of things is how much it deforms the space-time around it. So it doesn't matter if it's, you know, the Empire State Building or if it's the equivalent mass, you know, in some sort of lead object, or the only thing that's important is the mass. And so it can be the sun that's making the deformation of the space-time, or it could be something else, a black hole, a neutron star. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. What's important is its mass.
Gotcha. A weird kind of side question as I make you talk more about black holes. See, you didn't know I would just be asking 1,000 questions about black holes. You're like,
I love black holes.
Oh, good. Okay, good. And this doesn't even have anything to do with black holes, but it has to do with all of these forces and the spinniness. And see, this is me, the biologist. Like, you know, the spinniness of the things. Is that why most of the bodies that we think of throughout the cosmos are round? Because that's just the natural shape that things would take when they have these forces on them and when they're in orbit and when they're, you know, being kind of pulled on by other things. Because it feels like most everything is round.
Yeah, so this is the most energy-saving shape. Like if you were the absolute laziest thing in the universe and you had to pick a shape, you would pick a sphere.
I respect that.
Yeah, this is the way to save the most energy. This is the absolute bottom of the barrel. This is the easiest way to be.
Yeah.
But when you're spinning, sometimes you get a little bit non-spherical. Mm-hmm. Like the Earth, for example, is squished a little bit because it's spinning, right? So it's squished a little bit at the poles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it looks round to us like on maps because that's easier to draw. But yeah.
It's more or less round. But spinning can take its toll.
It's funny because we always think, I think that when we're in school, when we're young, and you know, a lot of us who are around the same age, I'm 32, went to school around the same time that I did, those of us who didn't really focus on physics, maybe who were afraid or who had the luxury in our minds at the time of choosing, you know, well, can I take this or can I take that? I'm going to take oceanography because it sounds easy. Also not easy. When I was in college, by the way, side note, I think I've said this before, I was totally afraid of science before I discovered it. And so I took 3 courses because I was required by my university to take 3 science classes. And at least one of them had to be a life science and at least one of them had to be a physical science.
Woo!
So I took oceanography. I took stellar astronomy.
Wonderful.
Yeah, which was really fun. And I took, I like to say I took paleontology, but in the course manual, it was actually listed as dinosaurs in all capital letters with an exclamation point.
I would have taken that.
Yeah, it's like,
that
how do you
sounds
not take,
awesome.
You're going through the course manual and you're like, dinosaurs! Yeah, you have to. So that,
absolutely.
And for a lot of us who I think had that resistance or that fear or whatever it might have been to science, and you know, some of us were lucky enough to come back around to it as adults, some of us are still a little, I think that one of the things that we remember from learning about physics, because we all took kind of physical science class when we were in elementary school or something, and maybe we didn't actually take physics with calculus or anything as an advanced mm-hmm. science. We learned a lot of Newtonian physics. Like we learned a lot of very classical. We didn't really start to understand general relativity. What we really didn't understand was quantum mechanics. I don't know very many people at all that learned quantum mechanics before, unless they were seniors who took like a higher level physics class, which is a bummer.
I think I can paraphrase Feynman by saying that anyone who claims that they understand quantum mechanics is lying.
Touche. Which is why high school physics teachers were like, nah, we're going to talk about the apple and the tree and Newton. No, and also I think part of it is because of how old we are. I think when we were young, we were looking at, you know, the classical drawings of atoms with the electron cloud orbits. And there was just a way that there's a static way that we looked at things. And I think that one of the approaches to teaching was this idea of like, things are this way. This is how Earth looks. This is how whatever looks. This is how blah, blah, blah. And it's because of the Big Bang and it's because of the blah, blah, blah. But we didn't really have this approach, which I think is a much more kind of new and fun approach to science. I mean, it's not new to scientists, but I think it's new in the educational realm of like, it's detective work. Like, oh, the Earth has this Absolutely. Weird shape. Let's figure out why.
Yeah. And that- or this is a rule or this is a law. Go out and test it. I mean, how many people have actually measured all of the angles inside a triangle, you know, exactly. to see if they add up to 180 degrees?
And it's hard. You're right. I'm like, yep, that sounds right. And it's hard to learn things from. Some people just have bad memories. All the people who have really good memories, they went to med school. Like, that's what they had to learn, all this crap, and they had all the mnemonics, and they just had to memorize a bunch of stuff. A lot of people have a hard time with, and so the way we remember things is, like, I remember taking an electrophysiology course, and it was the first time I had ever learned about circuits and having to draw, and I was like, be the electron, and so I'd, like, flow through the circuit to understand the difference between a capacitor and, you know. And
that's a great way to think about it. Sometimes I think of myself as a photon, a light particle.
Exactly.
To see, like, what would you see if you were a photon traveling around a black hole? Like, what would it look like?
And where could you go? And
yeah,
where would
you
get caught
go?
Up? And,
exactly.
Yeah. And I think that that's such a smart way to do it that we sometimes are missing when we're younger, is this kind of first person perspective, or this like, okay, you tell me that this is a law, or you tell me that this is just the way it is, but why?
And I completely encourage that kind of approach. It's so important to develop, in my opinion, your own personal relationship with science or with physics. When I was a kid, I loved hearing about black holes. Like, you just couldn't tell me enough. And I couldn't believe that people might one day pay me to study black holes. And as soon as I figured out that that was an option, I was hooked. I was like, why would you ever want to do anything else? I don't get it. Why would I want to do anything else? So it's something that I'm really passionate about. And you know, I'm not a fan of memorization. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, some things you have to memorize, but only the really basic things. And then it becomes more of an intuition. And it's important to question things that don't follow that intuition, either to shape your intuition because it was, you know, slightly misguided previously, or to really get that deeper learning. And once you can make all of those connections and really develop your own relationship with science, and there's nothing that you can't do.
Yeah, and that's really how a lot of big discoveries, and whether they're theoretical discoveries or they're kind of observable discoveries, that's how a lot of them really happened, was like some person was like, yeah, I don't really buy it. Like, I know that's what everybody says, and I know that's how it's supposed to work, but it kind of doesn't seem to fit with this one idea I have. And then they look more and more, and they go, oh, there's an exception to this rule. Or, like, I see, this rule only applies when you're talking about things of a certain size or a certain
exactly.
speed.
And this is what one of the differences between Newtonian gravity and Einsteinian gravity, in that you can, in very weak gravitational fields, recover Newton's laws, right? But it turns out that it's just a very special case of this much more general framework.
It's because we were thinking from this kind of evolutionary humanistic perspective, which is like, how does gravity seem to work on Earth to my body and my eyes and all of the things that I'm, you know, doing my experiments with? And that's really the first stage, right, of science, is to observe just what's around us.
Of course.
And then we get more, you know, cool toys, and we develop better tools with better resolution, and we start to go, oh, shit gets weird when you leave the planet.
Exactly. Not even, you know, it's controversial whether or not Einstein actually believed that gravitational waves even existed theoretically. There was a lot of confusion when the field equations came out, which is this general framework of general relativity. And it was so tough that, you know, people kept making mistakes. Einstein made mistakes. Everyone made mistakes. And they couldn't understand if gravitational waves were just some sort of weird mathematical thing that mm-hmm. came out of the equations, or if they were physical and detectable. And actually, it wasn't until the Hulse-Taylor pulsar was discovered, which is a pulsar with a neutron star around it. And it was found that its orbit decayed exactly according to the predictions that gravitational wave emission would make. So we know how their orbits would be in Newtonian gravity. You don't really expect much to change. However, if you're in the Einsteinian framework, these bodies are emitting gravitational waves, and that energy comes at the expense of the orbit. So the orbit shrinks.
Okay.
And by studying this neutron star pulsar binary, the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, over around 10 years, they discovered that it was shrinking at the exact rate of gravitational wave emission and won the Nobel Prize in 1993. So we know that gravitational waves exist, but this is, most people claim, an indirect detection.
Gotcha.
So we saw the effect. We know that it's shrinking like it should, but we haven't actually measured the stretching and squashing of space-time that the gravitational waves cause.
So what was actually being measured there?
So they were figuring out what the closest approach of these two neutron stars were. So a pulsar is a neutron star with its magnetic field axis misaligned with its rotation axis. So it looks like a lighthouse. As it spins around, it turns this rotational energy into radio beams, and it pulses at you, right?
So
each rotation is like a wink, like a lighthouse.
And instead of giving off light, it's giving off radio waves.
Yeah, which is light, just in a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah, we just need something different to detect it than ice.
That's right. That's right. So like Arecibo, for example, this really big radio telescope that you may have seen in GoldenEye. You know,
it's like satellite dishes, right?
Yeah,
yeah, they look like satellite dishes.
yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's funny. That's a telescope. Like, we don't think about that. We think of like
telescopes.
A telescope is like, it's got to have a lens and you got to look at it. But that's not, there's a ton of different kinds of telescopes.
Exactly. All that telescopes do is that they focus this incoming radiation, right? And so with radio waves, they have very long wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And so you need really big dishes to focus them. And with optical light, then those are shorter wavelengths. And so you just need, you know, something that looks like the telescopes that we use in Hawaii, for example, to look at. And if you want to go to really, really short wavelengths like X-rays or gamma rays, then you have to start getting tricky because they'll just tend to go through whatever detector you have because they have so much energy.
And that's why they have certain detectors that are like buried under the earth.
Yeah, or some that are even in space.
Gotcha.
Right? So if you look at the Chandra telescope in space, it has this really interesting way of focusing X-rays, right? You have these kind of concentric circles which try to just coax X-rays into grazing the side of them and focusing it. But it's tough work because they have so much energy, it's hard to stop them.
Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing that's confusing to me still is I get the electromagnetic spectrum in a general sense because you learn about it in biology, right? Like even though it's not even like a physics principle or a biology, it's a fundamental principle that we all kind of understand that thing there is radiation out there, and based on the shape and size of the wave or how fast the wave is and how high the wavelength is or the amplitude is, we can measure it in different ways, right? And there's, you know, two different ends. But our gravitational waves, they're not electromagnetic, are they?
No, they're not. They're gravitational radiation.
It's confusing
instead of electromagnetic radiation.
So are there other kinds of radiation that is not electromagnetic, like gravitational waves?
Yeah, gravitational radiation is not electromagnetic radiation. It is totally different.
Are there other things that are also radiation that are not electromagnetic?
Or gravitational?
I don't know.
Maybe.
I think that's why it's confusing to people.
I don't think so, but
we're so used to the concept of a wave being something that...
Like light. Right.
Or I guess sound.
Yeah. And sound waves, I think, are one of the best analogies for gravitational waves because while we can see things in the universe with our telescopes, with gravitational waves, it's like hearing things. So it's like, you know, suddenly turning up the volume and being able to not only see the universe, but hear it. You know, right before two compact objects like black holes or black holes and neutron stars merge, they have this characteristic chirp that happens, and it goes whoop.
And you can see that signal, and you kind of can quote unquote put a sound to it. Like you can
put a sound to it because it has a very specific frequency. So those gravitational waves for the smaller objects like black holes and neutron stars when they merge are in the kilohertz range. And so if we could hear gravitational waves, then you would hear a whoop.
They sing to you. I love that. Exactly. That's so cool. And, you know, I've seen really beautiful examples in IMAX movies before at museums. There was one playing at the Museum of Natural History in New York the last time I went, which was maybe a year and a half ago. It was at the same time that they had a dark matter, planetarium show with Neil deGrasse Tyson voicing. And then they also had this great, and I don't remember what it's called. Maybe you guys can tweet me and tell me, but it was this great IMAX movie about kind of the unseen universe. So they had all these beautiful camera tricks. So they did a lot of high speed and also low speed photography. They did a lot of cool stuff with IR and with X-rays. And I do remember there being a scene where they tried to kind of illustrate sound waves coming off of everything and bombarding and decaying. And you know, they kind of drew them as these ethereal ripples in the what we saw visually. And it's so crazy. I mean, we would have that problem that people who get their cataracts removed sometimes have, where when they first see again after they haven't had sight for quite some time, they have, or especially people who are congenitally blind, they often will keep their eyes closed even after they have their sight restored, because they say it's noisy. It's too noisy when their eyes are open because they're not used to that much input. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if we were adapted to see all of this stuff, it would just be way too, we couldn't make sense of the world.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how scientists have developed specific tools and specific ways to use those tools to receive the signals that they're looking for and make sense of things that you can't necessarily see, you can't necessarily hear. So I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of today's episode. And then when we come back, that's where I want to pick up, is how do you detect a gravitational wave? All right, we'll be right back with Dr. Chiara Mingarelli. I want to take a moment to thank Audible.com for supporting the show. Audible.com is the place to go for audiobooks. They have over 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including nonfiction, which you guys know that I love. But I'm excited to talk about a novel, a fiction audiobook, in just a moment. Guys, if you've never listened to an audiobook, I really do hope you'll give it a try. It's kind of like listening to a podcast. They're great when you're on the subway, when you're on the bus, when you're stuck in traffic, when you're at the gym. And of course, when you're in the lab, you know how old the pipetting starts to get and it makes you go insane. It's so nice when you have something to listen to. And for you, the wonderful listeners of Talk Nerdy, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. As I mentioned, I'm really into this new book that I just finished. I highly, highly recommend The Martian by Andy Weir. It is my absolute favorite new book. And remember, if you download it on Audible, you will own it forever, guys. It's not a streaming service. It's not a rental service. The My Library feature on it actually lets you access it from anywhere. Your computer, your phone, your iPod, even your Kindle. And it's yours to keep. So to download The Martian for free, or any other audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kara. Once again, that's audiblepodcast.com/Kara. Thanks, Audible. All right, we are back. And before we left, we were talking about this idea of gravitational waves being something that some people say, or that technically you can only indirectly detect, even though it's pretty obvious that that is what you're detecting. And so that's kind of something I want to understand a little bit better, because when you read the Wikipedia page, Yeah, I did that.
I should edit that.
It does kind of sound a bit like it's a theoretical concept.
Okay.
Which is something that, so that's why too, when I was like, ooh, we could talk about bicep too, and we could talk about, and you were like, well, you're like, yeah, we'll talk about all of that. But also I'm not a cosmologist. And then I was like, well, I don't understand why. Yeah. How do you, so like, what would you say is your area of physics?
I am a gravitational wave astrophysicist.
Astrophysicist. And yeah. You specifically focus on gravitational waves. Gotcha. Because cosmology specifically, among other things, focuses on the early universe, right?
Yeah, the evolution of the universe, how we got here, you know, generally speaking, but its structure, if it's open, closed, if it's flat, you know, the kind of... The really big picture stuff is cosmology.
And it's often very theoretical in nature. There is experimental work being done in that realm, of course. Like, that's what the Large Hadron Collider is all about, is trying to look for these different fields and trying to understand what's going on at a quantum level to help us understand the early universe in some aspects. But
that's one of the applications, definitely. But there for cosmology, there are... special experiments as well, like Bicep 2 that you mentioned, or Planck, which later on came around and couldn't reproduce the Bicep 2 results. And that's how we know that, that's how we know that they didn't actually detect these primordial gravitational waves.
So that's what they were looking for in Bicep 2, was they were looking for evidence of primordial wave kind of signatures from the early universe that would have validated a lot of... inflation theory, like a lot of aspects of inflationary theory.
Yeah, that's right. So right after the Big Bang, like 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang. So
pretty quick. Yeah.
pretty fast.
Yeah.
Pretty much immediately after the Big Bang. Was a really special time in the universe where quantum mechanics and general relativity were acting at the same time in the same space. So usually we think of general relativity is encompassing, you know, the motion of, really gravitationally, like really heavy things, like really massive things you need general relativity to describe. So, you know, black holes that are in spiraling or about to merge, you need general relativity after a certain point to describe, you know, the evolution of the system. You need general relativity and special relativity in some cases, if you're looking at things that are going close to the speed of light, to describe how your experiences are different depending on your reference frame. It really kind of takes away the idea that there's anywhere special, right? We're all just in different places and there's no absolute, you know, we're all just behaving relative to each other, but there's no absolute place where you can be. There's no... you know, special place where there's an observer who's watching everything in a position that you can always refer to.
Yeah, which
I can be that special place. You could be that special place.
Which is why those conversations about the edge of the universe get really mind fucky when you're talking about general and special relativity. But this idea of quantum mechanics also acting at the same time.
Sorry, I totally got
sidetracked. No, so you got excited. It's exciting thinking
about
this.
So this was a very special time. And the Big Bang caused gravitational waves back then. And then those gravitational waves in turn caused these patterns in the charged particles that were around back then. And then inflation blew them up, right? So inflation took something that was incredibly small and then made it massive. And, you know, the universe is still expanding and accelerating, but obviously this is a different, you know, phase of the universe. But anyhow, what I'm trying to say is that those gravitational waves made this imprint in those primordial charged particles. And that imprint, that pattern, was then blown up. And then the Bicep 2 experiment was looking for that very particular pattern in the sky, in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background.
And so that's that picture that we said, the CMB, that's that picture that we sometimes see that looks like it's a map of the sky that almost looks like the fuzz on your TV, but it's all like in hypercolor, right? It's like green and red and blue. And so what that is really is kind of like a picture from what we've gathered of the early universe based on the signals that we can detect today.
Yeah. So the So you're right. The cosmic microwave background radiation is from around 380,000 years after the Big Bang.
Oh, yeah. There is that whole thing where everything was too opaque.
That's right. On. So even photons, even light particles were all part of this like plasma, and they couldn't escape. It had to cool down enough for the light to escape from this cosmic goo. And that happened around 380,000 years. Yeah.
I love how we know. It's so funny, too, because I love how it's like, you know, around this time. But it's like the math really tells us, and a lot of the data that we've collected, it's like to the second. It's like pretty crazy how we know exactly when things happened so freaking long ago.
That, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about to the second. It's not my field of specialty. Maybe you know better than I do.
But that whole thing about the first fluctuation, the 10 oh, yeah, to yeah. the one, like that's to the 10 really to the small minus fraction 35. Of a second. That's impressive. Yeah,
absolutely. Impressive. I'm impressed by my colleagues who are cosmologists all the time. What they do is really amazing.
But what you do is also really amazing, because you, instead of having this kind of detective hat to figure out what happened then, are wearing your detective hat to try and understand what's happening right now, or maybe not right now, because that's a weird thing about physics too, right?
More or less. It's much more right now than cosmology.
More right now. But it is true that when you look at signals, that you're looking at like really old signals, right? Like
yeah,
in general.
By the time they get here, they're old. But again, that comes into this whole reference frame, right? So some of the stars that we see in the night sky might not be there now, but now does it really mean anything?
It's a weird. It's something that we forget, but it is kind of a cool philosophical thing to remember, is that we're looking at the night sky as it was when each of those individual points of light gave off that those photons from however far away. So the farther away the stars are, the older generally are that we're looking at. That's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, the older the light is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the older the stars are. The older the light is. Good call. So there could be, like, if we see a supernova, like, we're detecting something that, like, already happened a really long time ago, usually.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how far away it is. You're right. So something like the Crab pulsar was observed around 1000 AD, and that was a supernova, and it was so bright that you could see it during the day.
Wow.
And so I think that the Europeans were very bad at recording it, but the Chinese were awesome. They were writing it down. They were taking observations. And that's where we discovered one of the first pulsars, because that is a supernova remnant. And so when it was discovered, they were like, oh, my gosh, we know when that happened because the Chinese wrote about it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so we actually know when it happened on Earth. And then, you know, you can test these theories that tell you about how old these objects are. And so if you do the theoretical back of the envelope calculation to calculate how old the Crab pulsar is, you get something like 1,300 years old. But we know that it actually happened in 995 AD. Which is pretty freaking good,
that's
right?
Like
that's going from a theoretical, like we think it happened around then, kind of back of the envelope calculation, to being in recorded text in history.
And that's so, what a cool thing that we have these kind of, I would say probably minimal examples of really well-recorded sort of astronomical, that's not the right word, astrological.
Astronomical is the right word.
Astronomical is the right word. That's so funny because we use that as like, that's astronomical, right? Like, it's astronomically large. But yeah, that is like,
it's a great superlative. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty crazy that we have these handful of kind of recordings, because the truth of the matter is a lot of what you have to work with in your field is like really new.
Like it's very new.
When we think about history,
if you think that the Nobel Prize was given for indirect gravitational wave detection in 1993, right? That is not long ago.
It's not. But
what we're doing is so new. I mean, this is the centennial actually of general relativity. It's been around for 100 years, and so a lot of us are thinking, oh, we really got to get the fire under our butts and detect gravitational waves. It's been 100 years. But actually, if you think about it, you know, there's a lot of, it was really like mathematically really heavy stuff. And, you know, some scientists like to say that a good graduate student these days understands general relativity better than Einstein ever did. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be true, but there was a lot of stuff to get right at first. And now that that stuff's been figured out and that the images in our mind are a lot clearer, now I think we're really ready to move forward and make these first detections.
Yeah, because not only has the math improved and not only have the theories been worked out by so many different minds, you also have literally like physical tools that you didn't have back then. You have actual experimental evidence that you couldn't get back then because nobody had thought to build the thing that you needed to test it. Like, that's such a cool thing about science. And it's funny because, like you were saying, the Nobel Prize was given, what, in 93 for the, quote, indirect detection of these gravitational waves. And I'm sure because it's your field and when you step away from it, you go, yeah, it wasn't that long ago. But within your field, you're like, oh, that's ancient history. Like, we're way beyond that now. So that's the cool thing to me is like, how is it? And we kind of mentioned it with the pulsar and the neutron star. Is that what you said?
Yeah, pulsar. A pulsar is a neutron star. Gotcha. It's just this very special kind of neutron star.
And so in that binary system, was
the Hulse-Taylor pulsar.
One of them was a pulsar.
One was a pulsar. Gotcha. One was a neutron star. Actually, since then, some of my colleagues have discovered a double pulsar where both of them are pulsars. And so you can do really, really precise tests of general relativity, which put the Hulse-Taylor pulsar to shame. Actually, my colleague Marta Bourguet discovered this. She's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. You'll never know. The first time she told me that she discovered the double pulsar, I think I laughed because I thought that some really important old dude had done it, because that's my implicit bias. But really, she's a young woman who's lovely.
And she's like, yeah, I did that. Whatever.
She's like, yeah, let's get drinks. That was my PhD project.
Hilarious. No. Yeah. And so that's the other thing that I think is fascinating to think about, is that you are in many ways limited by these kind of astronomical events lining up the right way. Like, there are things you can't measure unless something passes in front of something at just the right time, or it spins in just the right, way that you can get the signal.
Yeah. So I haven't really spoken about detection yet, but we can go into that a little bit.
Yeah.
So my own work involves pulsar timing arrays. And what that is that we have this array of pulsars. So again, they're neutron stars, which are somewhat rapidly spinning. And the magnetic field axis is misaligned with the spin axis, so that every rotation, you see this kind of lighthouse beacon sweep around. Now, in particular, the pulsars that we use are called millisecond pulsars. And those are important because they're extremely stable. Up until a few years ago, they were more stable than atomic clocks for timing. So we know exactly, I mean, almost exactly, when these pulses of light should be arriving at the Earth. So this by light, I mean radio waves, because I think about electromagnetic radiation for me is all light, because in my, academic career, I think of gravitational radiation and electromagnetic radiation.
Which is all just, and some people do refer to anything along that, gamma rays to radio waves. It's all just a type of light.
It's light.
It's light that we can't see.
Exactly.
So when you say that you use an array, you're talking about these objects that just exist. They just are there. You guys or somebody before you found them, cataloged them, pointed to them.
Jocelyn Bell actually discovered pulsars, and at first they were called LGM signals, for little green men.
Aww. Because it was like, how is this so regular?
Exactly. How is it so regular? How is it coming from a particular part in the sky? It was really an incredible discovery.
So did people legit think that that was like a SETI finding? Like, not a SETI finding, but they were like, this must be intelligent life?
So from the rumors that I hear in the physics world, there were some very serious closed-door conversations about how to communicate back the signal, and how to respond to the signal and what the appropriate measures would be.
So it's like when you finally figured out what was going on, it's like an equally bummed and really excited, because, oh my gosh, look at this kind of basically this clock that nature gave us that just exists that keeps really good time that we can use as a reference point for a lot of other stuff. Yeah. Ooh, we can, you know, co-opt this and use it to advantage our advantage. But oh, bummer, we didn't find intelligent life.
Yeah. But Jocelyn Bell's discovery was really a game changer. So one of the ways that we use pulsars, so not all of the pulsars are that good, but millisecond pulsars are that good.
How many are there or that we know about? Do you know? Is it like a massive catalog or is it just like five?
Oh no. So there's hundreds of millisecond pulsars and but that we've detected. Not all of them are good enough for pulsar timing arrays. So in the international community, we might use around 50 more or less millisecond pulsars. But those are because we need to find ones that are especially good.
Gotcha.
They need to be extremely stable because we're looking for very small changes in the time of arrival of these pulses from the pulsars.
So if you're looking at a lag of like 2 milliseconds or something like that, they have to be hitting on the millisecond every
nanoseconds.
Time.
Yeah, exactly. We're looking for nanosecond deviations.
See, that's crazy that you even have tools that can measure nanoseconds. Like to me, and like, which is funny because we probably have had that for quite some time. But the idea that we can be that specific with our measurement is pretty dope.
Yeah, these pulsars are amazing. And what's important also is for them to be stable clocks over extended periods of time. So the gravitational waves that you can look for with an array of these pulsars are very low frequency. And that's because if you think about the electromagnetic parallel, so you think about something like Arecibo, this massive radio telescope, it has to be really big because the wavelengths coming into it are big and you have to be able to focus them. With pulsar timing arrays, our gravitational wave detector is massive. It's galactic scale. The pulsars are all in our galaxy and they're about 3,000 light years away. So one of our detector arms, the distance between the Earth and the pulsars is around 3,000 light years. And these are distributed all around us, all over the sky. So we have this massive kind of octopus-looking detector, right? Where you have all of these arms around you. And the detector is the size of the galaxy.
How is that a thing? Like, how does that... So, please explain this to me.
Yeah. So what's important here is that we have these really long arms to detect very low-frequency gravitational waves. So these very low frequency gravitational waves come from, for example, supermassive black holes when they first start orbiting each other, right? So when they're in their very kind of slow in spiral phase and their periods are around 10 years, for example, maybe 20 or 30, but along that order of magnitude, then they start, you know, you have these really, really low frequency gravitational waves. And so for one of those gravitational waves to go through the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to observe the whole thing, then you have to wait, you know, 10 years, 20 years, something like that.
Because that's how long it takes to travel.
Yeah. And so you really need your clocks to be stable over that period of time.
And so how does the and maybe this is too technical, but how does the little spinny beacon guy actually detect? Like what are you measuring?
So what we measure the time of arrivals, right? So we know when these little flashes from the pulsar should arrive, and we measure when they do arrive, and we can see changes in the time of arrival.
And so
over that period of observation.
So if you see a blip, like if you see something, it should be here, should be here, should be here.
It's more
now
like
it's here. Like what
exactly
what does
it's
that
kind
tell
of,
you?
The delay happens slowly over the course of your total observation time,
which is like 20 years,
something like that, right? Exactly. It depends on the pulsar. It depends, you know, some pulsars have been monitored longer than other pulsars. The Australians right now have monitored a particular pulsar for almost 30 years. They have an amazing, you know, they have an amazing data set on this one pulsar.
And do you use that data or do you use kind of different data from all over the place?
We do both. So there's three main pulsar timing arrays and there's a North American one called NanoGrav. Then there's the European pulsar timing array, the EPTA. And then there's the Parkes pulsar timing array in Australia. That's the PPTA. And together we share our data and we form the International Pulsar Timing Array. So we'll soon, once the Australians have finished extracting all the science they want from their data set, they'll share it with the rest of the community. And then we combine all of our data to try to look for more gravitational waves.
And are there redundancies in the data? Like in North America, are you sometimes looking at the same thing so you can double check each other?
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool. In North America and in Europe, we have some of the same pulsars.
Cool.
But the Australians see a totally different part of the sky.
Yeah.
Right. And so they have, I think that there's maybe like one or two pulsars that are similar, well, that are the same, but they're really hard to detect. You would only see them for something like 30 minutes in Europe and then it's gone.
Gotcha.
Right? But again, I'm not a radio astronomer, so that might be wrong. I hope not.
It might actually be 12 hours. It's close. You know,
So going back to the gravitational waves, what's important to think about is these wavelengths. So if you think about the period, it's something like, 15, 20, 30 years. And so you have to be monitoring the pulsar for that long, right? So that gives you the low frequency cutoff, but you can see things that are maybe a bit higher frequency. So there's two things that's at the bound on the gravitational waves you can observe with pulsar timing arrays. One, the high frequency bound is from how many times a week, a month, or a year do you monitor that pulsar. That thing is called the cadence of the observation.
Okay, so that's just like how many times have you seen that beacon coming?
Yeah, how many times have you said to your radio telescope, look at that pulsar, I want to take, a 30-minute observation. This is going to give me my time of arrival for right now. And then you do that for 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. And that gives you the high frequency cutoff. So one over the time gives you the frequency.
Okay.
So one over a few weeks gives you something like 100 nanohertz for your high frequency cutoff. And one over your total observation time, which may be around 10 years, gives you around 1 nanohertz, right? And nano, of course, is a billionth.
Very small.
Very, very small. So these are very low frequency gravitational waves.
Okay.
And so the sources for those are supermassive black hole binaries and also primordial gravitational waves, similar to the ones that they were trying to find with BICEP 2.
Mm-hmm.
But we look for them in a different way. So those would also cause these deviations in the time of arrivals of the pulsars, but in a different way than the ones from the supermassive black holes. So we look at things called the spectrum of the radiation. And from supermassive black holes, they have a very distinct spectrum. For gravitational waves, it's also distinct, or it will be once we can get the error bars down. They should be distinct, but when they will be distinct is still something that we're trying to figure out, because right now we haven't found anything, or else, my colleagues and I would have very nice gold medals from
shiny
Stockholm.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm kind of taking, so I got to admit, the part where you got mathy on me, I got a little lost.
Okay,
especially compared. No, it's okay. Especially compared to I was like, I think I get it. And now I guess one big question that I have, which is going to be a broader question, is would you compare gravitational waves, for example, to when I talk to Kate? No, you're fine. It's cool. It's okay. Sometimes cell phones ring, man.
Sorry.
I can't even hear it. I mean, I can feel it. Can I feel it or can I hear? They can hear it. They're like, hey, mom, what's up?
I think it might be my husband.
Do you need to answer? You could totally answer on air if you wanted to. You're like, I don't want to. That'd be weird. So when you compare, would you compare, for example, when Katie Mack was on and we were talking about dark matter and we were saying that, for example, we know it's there. We just can't measure. I mean, we can measure it indirect. Is it the same kind of a thing where it's kind of like, is one of them more theoretical than the other? Or are they both sort of things in physics that everybody accepts it within the community? These are real phenomena. And these are phenomena that we're physically measuring all the time. We just can't, they're a little bit too ethereal. So we need a secondary way to get the data.
So that's an interesting question, and I'm not really sure how to answer. So with dark matter, It only interacts gravitationally. And so you can see it by the way that light bends around it. And then you can infer how much matter is there.
That's the lensing effect, right?
Exactly, okay. Right? So you can see, for example, you know, how much matter you can see. And then from the amount of light that's bent around the object, you can infer how much matter is actually there. And the difference between the two tells you how much dark matter is there.
Gotcha.
And although I'm not an expert in this field, I believe that there are some experiments which are trying to directly detect dark matter.
And is there no way to directly detect gravitational waves?
And so there is. And so, for example, pulsar timing arrays and LIGO right now are the two main ways to directly detect them. So the indirect detection was watching the orbit of these neutron stars, one which was a pulsar, decay. Mm-hmm. That's an indirect way of looking at it. But with pulsar timing arrays, we can see the direct effect of gravitational waves on all of these pulsars. So if we only saw this time delay, for example, in one pulsar, that uh-huh. could be anything,
uh-huh.
right? You can come up with some sort of weird theory to say what happened.
Yeah, but if you see that, it was a wobbly guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's glitchy. It's old. Ignore it. Actually, pulsars, when they get older, get less glitchy. They're very well behaved.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
You like an old pulsar. He's like, old standby.
Exactly. Yeah. We like, they're stable. The old pulsars are stable.
Gotcha.
I think I lost my
That's
train
okay,
of thought.
Because I think that like the main question that I'm sticking with right now, which is like probably like my ears were asleep for 2 seconds when you answered this or something. Whose gravitational waves are you looking at then?
Oh, right. So that's
Is
right.
it the gravitational wave of something nearby then that's like bumping into the pulsar? Or is it the pulsar's own wave that it's creating? This is what I'm confused by.
Yeah. Okay. Good question. So the gravitational waves that pulsar timing arrays look for are mm-hmm. these, you know, they have periods of 15, 20, 30 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are from supermassive, for example, from supermassive black hole binaries.
So that's from shit that's huge, really far away, and probably pretty old. And
really
like,
massive.
Whoosh,
exactly.
Going through the universe, like whoosh.
Exactly.
And then you've got these little guys that are like pew, pew, pew. And they get bumped by one of them.
Yeah, so they get bumped, and then the signal, but also the signal that the Earth gets bumped,
uh-huh.
right? And the signal that bumps the Earth, that affects all of the pulsars in the array because all of their little light flashes arrive at the Earth at a particular time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you see that bump happening at the Earth and you know that there's a particular correlation that general relativity predicts for a correlation between all of the pulsars in mm-hmm. your array, then you can say, well, that's the smoking gun, right?
And
so we know exactly how gravitational waves would correlate if they were present and all of these pulsars by perturbing their signals at the Earth. So if this gravitational wave, for example, transits at the Earth, it would affect all of the signals at the Earth from the pulsars in a very particular way that would be very difficult to replicate any other way.
And like a predictable way. Like
it's
a way
very
that the model tells you what should happen, then if it happens, and then if it happens like again, then you're like, okay.
Yeah. So if it happens, then you're golden. But then as it keeps happening, your signal gets better and stronger.
And so has this happened yet?
No.
Okay. And so, but we thought that this happened in BICEP 2, or this was another type of detection.
So BICEP 2 was looking for
the primordial ones.
The primordial gravitational wave signature. And it
was
looking
on the low frequency.
That's a very low frequency.
Gotcha.
Very low frequency. And they're different parts of the frequency spectrum, mm-hmm. right? So this primordial signature is present across the whole gravitational wave band, you know, from nanohertz to kilohertz where LIGO is. And
and BICEP 2 was looking at the nanohertz side of it.
Well, no, so even smaller than that. So there's different scales that these perturbations are present on. And so the cosmic microwave background has these gravitational wave perturbations that happen at these different angular scales. And I'm trying not to get too technical here.
Are they like?
But we know exactly where they should happen.
Femtohertz?
No.
No. I know prefixes. So maybe to broaden up a little bit, just so that we don't get too technical, what we kind of found is that it looked like they had gotten these signals, and it looked like these signals mimicked what they expected if it were a primordial gravitational wave. Turns out something else that looks like that signal is like stuff that's happening in our own solar
system. That's right. It was
system.
Dust. It was dust in the galaxy.
Oh, in our own galaxy, not our own solar system.
Yeah,
okay.
It was dust in the galaxy, and it polarized it very cruelly.
It was just one of those things where it lined up. It's like the guy at the microscope who's the first guy to ever look at something, you know, something that's alive, and then he's got an eyelash that's like in the way, and then he's like, "Oh, I call thee the corpuscle of eye."
But it turns out
it was just his
eyelash. Imagine you were looking for something that looked exactly like an eyelash, and then you just happened to have an eyelash. But then, you know, you didn't actually see the eyelash. You saw your own eyelash. You didn't see the thing that you thought that you were going to see that also looks the same.
And this is, and it just turned, it was like a horrible fluke.
Well, it was just because, so one of the reasons why is because BICEP 2 only had data at one frequency. So Planck, which was a satellite which did the follow-up observations, had data at lots of different frequencies. And so they could see how the sky looks in all of these different frequency bands. And so they can really get a better handle on the dust. And so it was the dust is really what killed this experiment.
Well, not killed it.
It's just not a direct observation of this anymore. But it doesn't mean that people don't believe in inflation anymore, that it's not a great theory. It still is.
It's like if the Higgs field wasn't, you know, they couldn't find the Higgs boson, people wouldn't think that the Higgs field didn't exist. They would just keep looking. Like that time they didn't find it. Let's try and figure out another way to find it.
Yeah.
So guys, this is why reliability and validity are both important in science. This is what you take your stats classes and you realize that you got to reproduce the data. And then when you try to reproduce it and it doesn't work, then you can't sit there and still make that claim. You've got to kind of step back and be more cautious about it. There's still a chance that that is what they were measuring, right? But it's dwindling by the day. Oh, it's gone. I saw the look on your face. It's gone. It was dust.
It was most likely dust.
It was most likely dust.
It was most likely dust. And moving forward, they can keep taking data and they can keep working towards finding that signal. It doesn't mean that the experiment is dead. I mean, they might have to make their equipment more sensitive, and maybe there's some future work that's going to happen there. It doesn't mean that they'll never find it using that method. They just haven't found it yet.
Well, now that they know what the dust looks like, then they can use, you know.
Now that the these dust. Two experiments are sharing their data.
That's cool, too. That's a good outcome.
That's
a good
key.
Outcome. But
that's
you know what?
Key.
You don't work on BICEP 2. Why are we talking about BICEP 2? We were talking about the cool ways that you are, that you and your colleagues are basically still attempting at this point to get direct evidence of these gravitational waves, because it hasn't happened yet.
That's
which,
right.
Whether you understand the math, whether the science is still kind of murky, what a cool, I mean, you do, obviously, as a general you, the people listening. How cool is it, you guys, that, like, imagine, I'm sure some of you actually do this, which is freaking awesome, but, like, those of us who are lucky enough, I'm not one of them, again, the pronouns are getting confusing right now. How cool to be working on something that is totally uncharted. Like, nobody's done it yet. So when it happens, it'll be the first time it's ever happened.
It's awesome and it sucks.
Because it keeps not happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So it's awesome to try to think of all of the things that we might see, you know, and to predict the things that we might see. That's a real thrill when you can come up with this new idea and you can tell people how to test it and people start testing it and you just kind of wait and see, and it's just a waiting game to see if that's going to work out or not. It's a wonderful thing about science when you have this awesome idea and you write it down and, you know, your peers look at it and they say, okay, this makes sense, or this might not be your best idea. Try again. And then, you know, having these ways to test it and just waiting for those results to come back. Sometimes it takes longer than other times, right? For gravitational waves, we don't really know what level the gravitational wave background is at. So whereas before I was mentioning single sources, just a single binary.
Yeah.
two supermassive black holes orbiting each other, there's actually, you know, those are happening all around us in the whole universe. And it makes this kind of noisy background, which makes these little ripples like on the surface of a pond on a windy day.
Yeah. And like how hard to point to exactly what the source of each of those ripples
exactly.
is.
Exactly. So together they make a background that also has very distinct characteristics. And those characteristics in turn depend on the sources. And we're still trying, because we don't know what the amplitude of that background is, and that'll give us a lot of information about the source population, about these supermassive black hole binaries. But because we don't know where that is, I can't tell you how long it's going to be before we detect gravitational waves from these sources.
This sounds so hard. Like, not hard, like hard to understand, even though it is hard to understand, but also kind of easy because you're a really great communicator. But it just sounds hard to do.
It's like, really hard to do. And it takes a lot of people a lot of time to try to figure out how to do this. I work with a lot of really smart people at a really great research institute.
And you collaborate with people
all over the world.
Not even at your institute. Like other institutes and other people. And
absolutely. I have colleagues all over the planet.
Because
yeah.
as you're telling me this and you're using the pond ripply example, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, if I were a scientist who was tasked with trying to calculate and observe ripples on a pond, that sounds impossible. I know it's not, because there are people who are like really awesome at fluid dynamics who have like amazing modeling systems. But beyond that, in my mind, that seems insurmountable. Like, that's like, holy shit, how am I ever going to make sense of all of this? So the fact that then you're using that as a metaphor.
That's
the easy example for this really complicated thing that's happening at values that are hard for us to cognitively understand.
Yeah.
And using signals that are, you know, signals that are based on other things bumping into other things, and then you're getting the data. So it's kind of passed down indirect. And you're using tools that aren't even tools that you built. I mean, you do use tools that you built, but they're like other things that just exist in the sky. You're like, that's a cool clock because it is. And I'll use you to help me understand.
That's why I think it's such a beautiful experiment.
It is very cool. Because when you first mentioned, oh, it's like this detector that's the size of the galaxy, I was like, we don't have the capacity to build something that big, Kiara.
we can't build it, but that's the beautiful thing. It's already there.
That's my favorite part. A, because it's sort of the part I understand the best, but B, because it is really, really beautiful that we have managed to use nature in such and learn from nature in such a predictable way.
And that nature gave us these beautiful clocks that were discovered by a PhD student, Jocelyn Bell, who was stubborn enough to really want to understand what she was looking at, and discovered this really beautiful thing. She's one of my heroes for sure. She was just, you know, really stubborn, really looked into it, and eventually figured out what it was. And that's science.
And
stick to your guns.
And it's hard to do. I mean, we think about the things we do in our everyday life where something is like a weird little aberration or something doesn't sit right or it doesn't seem right. And we ignore all of them because otherwise we would be too overwhelmed. You're cooking something and you're like, why did it do that thing? Or you're writing and then there's like a weird blotch on the paper. And we never think to go like, that one tiny little aberration that is bothering me, I shall focus all of my time on. Because most people go, just kind of ignore that and we'll move on and we'll focus on the other thing that we're supposed to be studying. But that's how these major breakthroughs happen, is that somebody goes, oh, that's weird.
Exactly.
I think I'll spend the next year trying to figure
out
That's
how these discoveries happen. Someone says, oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I love it. It's so great. So, okay. I don't know if there's more to talk about. There probably is, which I always end every podcast being like, I need to have you back so we can dig into this more. Hopefully those who are listening, I think, got a good primer, which is what I was really hoping to be able to get across. I know I did. I learned a lot sitting here. But before, because I've taken so much of your time and it's like late at night and you're hungry, before I let you go, I have to tell you that I end every podcast the same way. And it is by asking my guests two questions, always the same two questions. And so I'd love to hear your answers to these two questions, putting you on the spot a little. And you can answer them in any context, whether it's, you know, your work, you personally, or a global thing, a social thing, a political, whatever. I want to know, A, what is the thing with regards to the future that you're most concerned about? What keeps you up the most at night? What is, you know, the thing that bothers you the most? And on the flip side of that, you know, what are you most kind of excited about? What are you most optimistic about?
So what keeps me up at night, I guess, what I worry about for the future is that people think that we're not the captains of our own ships and in charge of our own fate with respect to the planet. And to a certain extent, we are. And global warming is something that I think is really scary in the sense that some people are trying to convince themselves that there's nothing we can do about it. And they have this fatalist perception. And while I'm not a climate scientist, I know that over 99% of climate scientists agree that this is man-made and we need to fix it. And we are all responsible for doing this. Everything that you do in your life, from the car that you drive to how much you leave your lights on to the biodegradable or non-biodegradable products that you use, everything that you do impacts the planet. And it's easy to think that we're these really insignificant things and how is what I'm doing important or how is it going to make a difference? But it does make a difference. And if we all do something, you know, we may be able to really turn the tide on things like climate change, even though right now I despair because I think that this has been an issue for a really long time and it's an inconvenient truth. You know, people find it easy to ignore, you know, even that there's a drought in California because no one's telling you how long you should take in the shower. But then you see these satellite photos and you see the reservoirs are empty. And if you drive from LA to San Francisco, you know, it's just desert. And where there used to be, you know, orange groves, there's now just these big stubs of leftover, you know, fruit farms. So it's real. And everyone is responsible. I'm responsible. You're responsible. My husband is responsible. It's really important for us to see that we are responsible and we can also do something.
So really for you, it is two sides of the same coin. You're both kind of, like you said, despairing about it and really concerned about it, but you're also optimistic because you know that we have the capability to make change.
Yeah, it's just maybe not profitable. And that's something else that I'm deeply concerned about.
As am I. I'm very pro-regulation in that sense, because I do think that if left to our own devices, we will be greedy until it kills us. You know what I mean? And not just we, I mean, but corporations are people.
that in itself is extremely disturbing.
It's extremely disturbing. Citizens United is extremely disturbing. But one thing that we do have to remember is that corporations are run by people.
Exactly.
It is people at the helm.
People run it and people can make changes as long as, you know, the population and the masses demand it. And I think that we need to demand change and not in a kind of meek way, but in a really serious way, or else the planet will survive. It's not the planet I'm worried about. It's humankind. We'll just, you know, create this new environment, which is perfect for some other species, but not for us. And that's what I'm worried about.
It's true. The cockroaches will inherit the earth.
Absolutely.
Spoken like a true Canadian.
Yeah.
I love it.
All right. So what I'm looking forward to the most... I love technology. I love everything about technology. I can't wait for my home to know, you know, exactly what temperature I want it to be at. And I want it to be, you know, off the grid and green. And I want to make use of all of the, you know, free energy that we theoretically have access to. I, you know, love Star Trek and I want everything to be like Star Trek, which is maybe very idealistic of me, but I think it's possible. And I just can't wait for the future to see what I can't even think about. If you told me when I was a kid that every night I would read my Kindle and this was made by e-ink and that me looking at a page is the same as having the battery off because, you know, these ink particles aren't moving on my page, you know, it blows my mind and it's so awesome. Or that my whole CD collection would fit on my phone, and my phone can do almost everything for me. I mean, this stuff is so awesome. And if that stuff has happened between me being, you know, 15 and 30, I mean, what's going to happen in the next 50 years? I honestly can't wait. I'm really excited for the future if we can make it that far.
You are making me so excited. My one fear, though, is that I'll be like my grandma is. And I'll be like, I can't understand this newfangled technology. I want
Give
my,
me back
iPhone,
my
back.
iPhone. Yeah, exactly. The 4S. It's too big.
That will happen. You know that will happen to us.
Well, I think I can't wait until it's seamless, until, you know, there's no distinction between us and Thor, you know,
yeah.
Where it's just everything is so seamlessly integrated and we don't even notice it around us anymore. I think that'll be really awesome.
It's really cool. You know, that's where I think this new acronym, this STEAM acronym, really comes into play.
What's STEAM?
We talk a lot about science, technology, engineering, and math.
Oh, STEM.
But when you add the arts and you call it STEAM,
oh.
Which I have problems with in some respects, but in other respects I really embrace, that's why it's so important, because when we talk about technology really changing our lives, it's only partially the newest and the greatest and the thing it can do. And it's partially how intuitive is it? How is it designed?
Yeah.
Like you said, to be seen. And that's not passive. That is an active decision that very intelligent people are making,
yeah,
to make our lives easier and to make us be able to just pick up a tool without reading the manual,
yeah,
and just use it. And that's,
yeah,
that blows my mind. That's
I think that
so
laptops
cool.
will become obsolete. You'll just mm-hmm. have smart surfaces all over the place. All your stuff will be in the cloud. I'll sit at your table and just, I don't know, maybe use my fingerprint, and then it'll just kind of pop up like it's a terminal window, right?
And we'll be able to get rid of these shitty old microphones.
Hopefully the houses won't be bugged with really.
You know they will. We'll go, yeah. And then the thing that's recording in your brain, we'll just, you know, put that straight out. Okay, now it's getting dystopian. I'm freaking out.
Uh-oh.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
I want to make sure, and you tell me if you want to, but usually when I have people on the podcast, I like to make sure they can give their social media information out so that people can contact them, read the work that they do. I don't know if you ever blog or if you ever do any popular science communication of the work that you do, but definitely if you, you know, try to curate your Twitter or your Facebook and tell people what's going on, let them know where they can find that.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm gravitate_to_me. Gravitate to me.
Oh, I love it.
Because I love gravity. And I'm, I've also got a website where I have all of my research and also my publications, and that's chiaramingarelli.com.
Wonderful. Perfect. I'm actually clicking that in right now so I can link to it. So that will also be linked to in the notes, not the notes, but the metadata on the show. So you guys can check that out when you click on the episode.
And if people are really interested in pulsar timing arrays, I'm teaching a summer school course at Caltech this week on pulsar timing arrays. And that is being recorded.
Oh, cool.
And on my website, it should have a link to it. So you'll have an hour and a half of introduction to gravitational waves, but from a slightly more mathematical approach for those of you who like to talk really nerdy.
Talk nerdy. I love it. Thanks for that. That was good. I'm looking at your website right now, and it's really beautiful. We need to talk about that, too. Is this a Squarespace website? Can I ask you?
No, it's Weebly.
Oh, it's really well done. All right. Okay. We're done nerding out. I'm so glad that you joined. It was really fun for me. It was really fascinating. I love to be able to do kind of a harder science episode periodically and you know, push the limits of my brain. So thank you for joining. Thank you for doing that. I know that the listeners are going to have a lot of fun with this one too.
I hope so. It was my pleasure to be here.
It was so good. So everybody who's listening to, thank you once again for coming back week after week and supporting the show, listening, spreading the word. You guys are amazing. I couldn't do it without you. I wouldn't want to because it'd just be me talking to nobody, so that'd be weird too. But thank you again for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.